My guest today is South African-born British novelist and a short story writer. She was a children's critic for The Independent on Sunday and The Times, where she was one of the first to spot the Harry Potter books and Philip Pullman's trilogy, among others. She's written 7 novels and 1 novella, all highly acclaimed and often deeply relevant to the current political and social situation. She's been compared to both Dickens and Balzac, and her comments on the state of the nation are remarkably insightful. She has not one, but 2 new books out this year. Amanda Craig, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in. For a writer who is so deeply in tune with the British nation, it might come as a surprise that not only were you born abroad in South Africa, but also you spent great parts of your childhood in Italy.
Yes, well, I think I'm very, very lucky in that respect because it makes me an outsider looking in, but also an insider looking out, which is really what you want for a novelist, I think. You always have a little bit of distance. And I think also it's what makes me very interested in writing about contemporary Britain and sometimes Europe, that little bit of distance and appreciation and also criticism.
How came you to be wondering about the earth?
That's a very big question. My parents were both journalists in South Africa. They left when I was a year old because they hated apartheid. They covered the Sharpeville massacre, which older people might remember. Then my dad went and worked for the UN in Italy, the Food and Agriculture Programme. So I grew up, in a sense, very aware of things like world hunger and climate change and political corruption. So a lot of that was always in my mind. And then coming to this country and seeing it really as I do still see Britain for all its problems as a kind of paradise. I think it's amazing to be able to walk around London, the greatest city in the world, and as a woman to be unmolested, to be able to make a living here. It's incredible energy and diversity. I love all that. I find that intensely stimulating.
You went to Beedale's, which has a reputation as quite liberal.
Yes, supposedly progressive. Yes, I hated Beedale's. I found it full. There are some very, very nice Beedalians, I should add. They're not all tarred by its brush, but I did find it an absolute viper's nest of entitlement and bitchiness and damage. You know, a lot of rich people sent their children there when they were about to be divorced or were in the process of divorcing, which also perhaps made me very early on very aware of what divorce and too much money could do to people.
And of course, all of those strands and Italy, in fact, come into various of your books. Were you always going to be a writer?
Yes, from the age of 12. I wanted to be a doctor before then. But I was no good at maths, so sadly that was not really an option. But I'd always read. I'd always, almost my first memories are of reading books. And I carried that absolute passion for children's books on into my adult life, both as a critic and then as a novelist, because in a sense, all my novels, among all the other things that I hope they are all fairy stories. There is a kind of template that I'm following.
They're great sort of morality tales in a way, aren't they? I mean, I think that comparison to Dickens is absolutely right, that whole kind of gritty social realism, but overlaid with a great plot.
Thank you. Well, that's always what I'm trying for. I mean, a lot of people now get compared to Dickens. I mean, he's very much come back into vogue. But yes, I suppose that strong conscience, the love of comedy, the love of plot, the love of very strong detective story elements, and characters. I'm very, very touched when people say how much they love my characters, which is just as well because I carry them on from one book to the next. I mean, each book can be read independently, but minor characters become major ones and major characters become minor ones. So there's this whole world, really, that I'm carrying around in my head.
Absolutely. I mean, one of your characters that's always really struck me was the taxi driver in Hearts and Minds, who was Zimbabwean. And so that was a character that I felt I particularly could understand, but was amazed that somebody who isn't Zimbabwean, who doesn't know that man, probably, this fictional man, but absolutely knew him and sort of introduced me to one of my compatriots. It was extraordinary.
That's so lovely to hear.
But I wanted to actually talk about a little bit about advertising and PR, because you started off with the devil's work.
Yes, well, I'm actually using that right now, the new novel I'm writing now. Yes, why on earth did I go into advertising? I think it was at the beginning of the 80s, and there were other novelists like Martin Amis and Faye Weldon who'd gone into it, and I thought, this sounds like a way of being creative and actually being able to have a little bit of money, and it all sounds quite interesting. And much, I'm afraid, like Beadells, I simply hated it. You know, it was not for me. It's very important in a capitalist world that it exists, and good ads are indeed very creative and entertaining. But I was working on things like Purcell, which was not very exciting.
But I mean, good PR, there is a place for good PR, and we love Absolutely. Good PR people, but it can be soul-destroying work.
Yes. Now, I think done well, it's marvellous. It makes a huge difference. I've got a completely wonderful woman at Little Brown doing my PR who has made the most enormous difference to my life. It's a real education working with her. But I've also had some very bad experiences with PR, both as a journalist and as a novelist. Mm. People who really don't seem to understand it is a profession. You've got to do it conscientiously and seriously.
You made that crossover to journalism. Tell me about that.
Well, yes, it's not a crossover that is as natural as many people assume. There are lots of fantastic journalists who can't write fiction to save their lives, and vice versa. I always wanted to write fiction. It was always a question of how on earth to earn a living, because even now I earn very, very little money. Like most novelists, I'm below the minimum wage. So without journalism, you really couldn't manage at all. Of course, now with journalism, it's all a lot tougher, because newspapers do not have the circulation they once did.
Now, children's books, of course, became your specialist subject in your journalism, a great critic and reviewer of children's books. That space seems so squeezed at the moment.
Oh, it's appalling. It breaks my heart. It really does, both for the absolutely brilliant writers that are around now, and more than anything, for the children. They need the very best literature, and they're not being told, and teachers and parents are not being told who is good. So as a result, you get people who just have lots and lots of money thrown at them, including celebrities who don't even write the books themselves, being promoted, and fabulous writers being wholly neglected. Mm. It was one of my great sources of pride, in fact, when I was doing it at the Times, that I discovered all sorts of people like Cresta Cowell, How to Train Your Dragon, The Hunger Games, Twilight, you know, all these books that did not have, when they first came out, the enormous budgets to push them. In fact, they were really badly published. And, you know, I would time and time again pick these books up because I bothered to read 100 books a week enough to see what was going on, and then I would read more and more and more. It was very hard work, and I was paid the princely sum of £100 a week for this. And even then, the Times decided they would get rid of me and do it in-house. The person they've got doing it is a perfectly good journalist, but she's not a specialist. Mm. And somehow, a lifelong love of children's books has made me that, and it's very sad not to be able to use it.
Of course, the way that people consume fiction is utterly changing, and it may not be that they're even reading a story, they're in a game or whatever. Mm. And do you think that that has some kind of bearing on it, that children perhaps aren't reading as much, and is it damaging?
Gosh, well, those are very big questions. I think things like gaming are extremely interesting. I think that the more they develop, they are becoming an art form, much like film. I mean, they're very interesting in themselves, but they have been very coarsely done. These games where you're just shooting people, I think, are, I would have thought, quite obviously not going to create a better society or a better citizen. And they are different from the experience of reading. I think there will always be children who fall in love with books, as I did, and most people who read voraciously do. But I do think it's a different thing that happens to your brain. I think it's an enormously important thing. It activates your imagination. It's not just a passive activity. It's something that I think is quite creative. When you sit and read a book, when you're really reading, it's like seeing a movie in your head. You know, you can see and feel and think, and you're totally taken out of this world into another one. And that is a fantastic experience. It's unlike anything else. And I do think that it makes people more empathetic, more interesting. Any man who says, oh, I can never find, you know, a woman who loves me, go away and read lots of books. You know, that really is the answer. Yeah. And people who keep making mistakes in their choices in life, I always want to say, go and read more books. Mm. You know, books are a wonderful concentrated burst of life. You know, read them, think about them, and you will, I'm pretty sure, start making better choices. You'll certainly have more to entertain you.
Absolutely. What about the role of a critic? We've talked about sort of flagging up books that otherwise may have gone under the radar. It's that, obviously, but it's also highlighting their faults. Can you review a book you hate?
Oh, yes. And sometimes that can be great fun, I'm afraid, for everybody except the poor author. I think that the bad review is an essential part of criticism. Unfortunately, I think two things have more or less killed that in its tracks. One is the internet, that, you know, the internet has, in a wonderful but also horrible way, made everybody think that they are equal to everybody else. And in a political sense, they are, but in an aesthetic, artistic sense, they are not. You know, people who just read are not the same as critics who spent absolutely years honing their craft and thinking about the subject and who are devoted to it. The other is that when I first began writing and reviewing and publishing fiction in the 90s, it was a blood sport, and people would make their reputations trashing books, not always books that deserved to be trashed. And this was a kind of blood sport. And I satirised this in my third novel, The Vicious Circle, which upset a great many critics, including one who was an ex-boyfriend who tried very hard to stop the novel from being published. He claimed that he was libelled as its villain. I'm afraid there were really rather a lot of villains in those days, not just one. He may have been one of the nastiest, but it was by no means a unique position. And I think this gave the whole world of reviewing and books quite a nasty reputation from which it's taken a long time to recover.
Of course, your first book came out in 1990, and I wonder how easy it was to, that was Foreign Bodies. I wonder how easy it was and remains to be a critic whilst also being a writer.
Well, I wasn't a critic when I began as a novelist, which is a slightly unusual and foolish way round because I was a successful journalist and feature writer, and I'd won a couple of prizes. And I think this meant that people sharpened their knives and thought I was a lot more successful than was the case. And the moment I started reviewing, people realised I too had my little knife and were not quite so cavalier. It was a very, very unpleasant world. It was not a happy world. And I think that because of that particular time in history, there is a whole generation of writers like myself who are not nearly as well known as we might have been if we had been published 10, 15 years later when the economy was very different.
So Foreign Bodies in 1990, then A Private Place, which came out a year later. Now, that was about a school. It sounds very much based on your school experience. But we come back to schooling and to literature for children again and again through various things that you've written. And indeed, one of the books that's coming out this year, your novella, is a quick read. Explain to me what quick reads are and what it was that actually pushed you to write this particular book.
Well, it's actually come out, in fact. It's called The Other Side of You. Quick reads are this really rather wonderful series that the Reading Agency asks well-known writers who they know can tell a story to write a short book. It's longer than a short story, but very much shorter. It's under 20,000 words than a novel. And it can be about anything under the sun. as long as it's written in your style, but slightly simpler words. I'm very against ever writing down to anybody, whether you're 6 or 60. And because I carry characters on from one book to the next, I suddenly thought, well, there is this character from A Vicious Circle. He's a little boy. He's a mixed race boy on a rather horrible sink estate in North London. And I wonder what he's like now, almost 20 years on. I make him more like 17, 18 in the story. And it was about this boy who's a teenager who's seen a murder. He's seen the woman who's been looking after him in care on his estate murdered, and he's on the run. And it opens with him seeing the knife and the blood and just running, and this whole gang culture that he's grown up with and refused to be part of, which is after him. Mm. I've always been interested in hidden worlds, and I think the world of the have-nots, sort of anywhere, whether it's in London or in the country, is something that I do address again and again. I'm very sad that it's not something that is seen with more sympathy, more knowledge, more compassion, that people who are poor, who may be perfectly intelligent, good people, are seen now as scum. Mm.
You were burgled, and this was quite instrumental in your thinking behind this book, and indeed in getting involved in Quick Reads, which aims to help children or young people who don't have those reading skills.
I had the experience of fighting a burglar who broke into my home, partly because he was trying to steal my laptop with my latest book on it, which I hadn't sufficiently backed up. And I am the daughter of a man who has a lot of Viking genes, and I'm afraid these kind of burst out. It was a horrible experience. I did also identify him, so he did go to prison. And it took a long, long time to process. But after I'd got over the shock of it, I did go on thinking about what had made this young man as he was. I mean, I've no idea. I knew that he came from South London, which was why in my story I make this boy, Billy Will, from there. All these things feed into what I write about, not in a direct autobiographical sense, but they do, of course, affect you and work on your imagination.
Yeah. Well, of course, Lie of the Land is very much about that, and it addresses the very affluent society, but also the divide between city and country living. And I think for many of us, we look at the country and we have this wonderful fantasy about how great it would be to live in a cottage and be surrounded by fields. But as you point out, actually, the reality can be very, very different. You're looking at very poor towns, people working on zero-hour contracts. Really, the poverty of the countryside is what you point out.
Yes, I mean, the poverty is very shocking, and I know a bit about it because 10 years ago we bought a semi-ruined house in Devon, and we didn't know it, but one of the reasons why we could afford this place was because it's a very, very poor bit of Devon. It's a sort of northwest bit, and a local councillor came round and knocked on our door and said, could you possibly give this man, who's lost his license as a lorry driver, some work because he's totally on his uppers. And we were rather surprised and said, yes, I'm sure we can find something to do. And we got talking and she said, do you realise that this part of Britain is not only one of the wettest, but it's as poor as Romania? And to our astonishment, we found that this was the case. People there are tending to live on between £12,000 and £15,000 a year. You cannot live on that, especially not when you need to have a car just to buy any food. And it's very horrifying and very interesting at the same time to see how people do kind of survive, but the problems that they have as a result of this, and how they are totally neglected by London and the politicians. Politicians hate the countryside. It was no surprise to me at all, and this comes into the Lie of the Land, that people, particularly in the southwest and the northeast, voted for Brexit. And I think a lot of that was not just that they were lied to or that they were ignorant, or and not that they were raving racists and bigots. It's that they felt so angry. It was a protest vote. And it's just horrifying because, of course, they are the people who are going to suffer the most because of this. They don't quite understand it yet, but that is quite clearly what's going to happen. And this makes my novel sound something that it's not, because it is a serious novel, but it is also a comedy, and a black comedy about a couple who can't afford to divorce and their shock as rather privileged, somewhat stuck up in the case of the husband situation, and when they lose absolutely everything, they lose their home, their jobs, their income, and suddenly they are exposed to this kind of life. It is, I hope, a funny book. Men are loving it as well as women.
Well, it has a cracking story. I mean, it has this crime story, this thriller element in it, which I love. And I think, I mean, you were talking earlier about overlaying the social reality with that element. It works incredibly well, doesn't it?
Good. Well, I hope so. It took me a long time. It took me 7 years to write. And it is a very complex book. It's like it's very easy, I hope, to read. But it is, in plot terms, like a French plait. You know, there are these four different main characters whose lives are interweaving with each other. And yes, a very gruesome murder at its heart, because the reason why this couple can afford their horrible, damp, dark house is that it's been the scene of a really nasty crime.
Spoiler alert,
I'm not going to say it anymore.
Now, you do always seem to be able to predict what's going to happen politically in your books.
Yes, it's very weird that. I mean, people get a bit twitchy. I think some of it is being married to an economist, which is quite useful. If someone can see what's happening in the economy, it's a bit like having a weather forecast what's about to hit. But some of it is, a lot of it actually, is just paying attention to what's going on, what people are saying, you know, these little indications. The novel begins with something that a real-life politician in the last Labour government said in a famous note, which is, "There is no money." And that was the start of the recession.
Yeah.
No, very, very horrible. So I did know about a year before most people that this recession was coming and that it was going to be really bad. And in a sense, the Quentin and Lottie Breeden's marriage, somewhat in an accelerated way, because it's set over a year, reflects that. Obviously, it was finished just as the Brexit vote was coming in. And there was a time just before that where it looked as if the economy was going to recover. I'm not so sure it will now for a bit.
The pie factory is something that really interests me in this book. So this very privileged boy who's never really got his hands dirty with anything goes off to work in this mass food company, really, which has some lovely kind of bucolic name and label, but really...
Humble pies, yes.
Doesn't really... I mean, what we're looking at is lowest level, mass manufactured tosh that's coming out.
Yes. Well, there are several things I'm attacking in a way. That one of them is the culture where people are being paid below the minimum wage, and it's a 0 hours contract where you're just summoned by text every time your work is needed, and your employer has no duty of care or proper contract with you. I think quite a lot of people of my generation actually did do jobs like this in the holidays as students. It's less common now because it's been largely taken over by immigrants. And having written about immigrants in my previous book, Hearts and Minds, in London, I was then very interested to think about them in the country, and very surprised as well to find out how many Poles and Romanians and all the rest there actually are doing the potato picking and the fast food factories and the hotels, and how disliked a lot of them are by the indigenous people, who you can see it from both sides. They don't want to be paid some absolute pittance to pick daffodils or dig up potatoes, but they still resent immigrants and foreign workers from taking those jobs.
Amanda, with your ability to predict what's coming...
I wouldn't claim that.
Well, I want to ask about your next book, because clearly that's what we should be looking at politically and socially.
Well, my next book is, again, very much about the haves and have-nots. At the moment, it's largely focused on the housing crisis, because this is something that is so terrible for my children's generation and slightly above. And it's also a version of Beauty and the Beast, which is a fairy story that in the novella, The Other Side of You, I use, which is my favourite fairy story about transformation and seeing what really matters about someone. And it's also a thriller. There was so much very dark material left over from The Lie of the Land about divorce and the violent feelings that it elicits. By the way, none of this is at all autobiographical. I'm lucky enough to be very happily married. But the stories that I was told by particularly women friends about how their ex-husbands behaved towards them was so upsetting and so monstrous. And of course, in many cases, I'd known their husbands and was really appalled at what they were capable of, that I wanted to use this much darker stuff in a new novel. So this is being written much faster. There won't be a 7-year wait. There'll barely be a 2-year wait. And it's written in the first person. But it's, again, about chiefly Cornwall, not Devon this time, but the country and the city and the rich and poor. I do think it's become as pressing as it was for the Victorians to write about this kind of thing. I hope more people will start to address it in fiction and indeed in film and television. I'm sick to death of all the endless bonnets and bustles and nostalgia about a past that never existed.
Well, until that comes out, we have this. The Lie of the Land by Amanda Craig is available right now. It's published by Little Brown. Amanda, thank you so much for coming on. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the sound engineer Christy Evans and researchers Daphne Karnitsas and Maddie Speed. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.